case is...
It out.
Yes. The matter of John Doe versus Regents of the University of California. Yeah. Oh, I'm excited. Where is it? Okay, I guess the question we have for you, you don't have to tell us. We know what the case is about. We've examined it extensively.
Thank you.
Here's the big question, what this case is about in our view. Where's the due process?
Where's the due process?
Yeah, because I'm having some difficulty finding it. So you help me find it.
Well, I think the due process is set forth in the Code of Student Conduct that, frankly, labels itself as due process. This is the due process.
That doesn't make it due process what the label is, does it?
Well, no, but at least gets us, I think, on the road down to where we're going. The university sets forth what due process it affords its students. And
wait a minute.
Yes.
Just think about what you just said. The university defines what due process is.
Well, I don't
get that.
I understand Your Honor's point. The university sets forth the procedures by which it adjudicates student discipline. The larger law tells us what due process is, and I believe what it comes down to is what due process is enabling a student, such as my client, to be able to present a meaningful defense at a disciplinary hearing, not just any defense.
Yeah.
I'm more than happy to admit that what the university provides is notice of the charges and an opportunity to be heard.
Yeah.
And those are, frankly, the bases for due process. But the procedures go further than that. And the procedures state, not only are we going to give you notice of the charges and an opportunity to be heard, we're going to allow you to call witnesses. We're going to allow you to present evidence.
Yeah.
Because the people who make up the hearing panel are not trained attorneys, we're going to dispense with the formal rules of evidence, and we're going to proceed based on common sense.
Of course.
And that's all fine.
Yeah.
And we have no criticism of the procedures that the university has laid out.
Right. Did it follow those procedures?
No, it did not.
Okay.
What the university did was, throughout the hearing, the disciplinary hearing, it applied the procedures in an ad hoc manner, in a way that supported the complaining witness Jane Rose case, each step of the way, while dispensing with the formal rules of evidence and all the formalities.
Which was that's all right, that part.
Right.
I mean, as a proposition. Yeah.
Right. And basically what they did was they put their thumb on the scale when it was good for the complaining witness and bad for my client. And they did this with respect to his ability to present expert witness testimony. And I know that throughout the briefing, both below and here in this court, the respondents have indicated that, well, you know, you're not entitled to come forward with quote-unquote expert testimony. That's not specifically granted, and it isn't. But what the university tells the students is you can present witnesses. You can present evidence. It doesn't say that, doesn't rule out expert testimony or expert evidence. Just as you can present evidence and you can present witnesses. And so when it came time for the university to offer its evidence with respect to, for example, the sexual assault response team report, it was more than happy to offer up the testimony of Detective Arvizo, who had done her investigation, and then was allowed not merely to testify as to the seven-word phrase that it disclosed to my client the night before the hearing. I mean, that would have been bad enough. But what the hearing committee then allowed Detective Arvizo to do is to basically say, I'm Detective Arvizo, and this is what I do all the time. And I've read any number of SART reports in the past, and boy, this one looks a lot like the ones I've seen before, and therefore...
In fact, I have the SART report here, and everything is blocked out. There's nothing there.
That's correct. And I found it ironic that in respondents' briefing, they refer to it as a redacted report.
Yeah.
You know, I've been practicing for 38 years, and I must say that that's quite a redaction.
It's like almost 98% redacted, right?
And frankly,
it's a form.
Well, and frankly, even Judge Geck down in the Superior Court indicated in her opinion, and granted she ruled against me, but even Judge Geck indicated that perhaps the better thing to do down at the hearing would have been not to have allowed the seven-word phrase in at all and not to have allowed Detective Arvizo to talk about this because it's so clearly unfair and put my client completely behind the eight ball. But nonetheless, that's what happened. And that's merely one example of what I call the ad hoc approach that the hearing committee did in terms of either following or not following the rules of evidence.
May I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes, please.
The approach that has been ongoing here has been, I think, a good legal point-by-point attack or comment or question. I have a slightly different take, and I wonder if I'm just out of the ballpark, and that's not one of those self-serving, you know, where I'm going to give you a wonderful me story. And a 19 or 20-year-old kid is accused of a crime which could result in a major prison sentence and brought before a board of non-lawyers to determine his life. He is not permitted to bring legal representation or even adult representation.
Well, he could bring a lawyer, I believe.
I was getting there. Who can't participate in the proceedings.
Yeah, sorry.
The record of this case, theoretically, had it been, what advisements were given to him, I don't know. But the first advisement, it seems to me, would have been the Miranda advisement that you shouldn't say a word in this proceeding. He was looking at a potential life sentence. And if due process means notice and opportunity, I know this is preachy and I apologize to you, but I stood back and I read this record and I was stunned. The university procedure, which purports to be fair and equitable, puts a kid who's trying to get a college education in the position of essentially being an attorney in a major sexual assault case. And if you stand back and look at this, it cries out, they didn't have a chance.
What?
And I know you'll have a reply to that, but reading this, and I ask you this question now that I've given you my gestalt on
sure.
The whole thing. If we cede to the university the proprieties of what I believe to be a fraught regulation, what, if any, is the guidance you would suggest we have or the role we have in reassessing the facts of this case in a circumstance where substantial evidence may rear its head in some way, and substantial evidence is like dead on arrival, and here's a case where maybe it's revivification. That's a long harangue, I'm sorry, but I read this record, and I find it just stunning.
Well, Your Honor, I had the same reaction the first time that I read the record, and frankly, and maybe it's inappropriate for me to make this comment, but when this case came to me, I was reluctant to take it. Simply, I represent students and faculty in cases like this. But I was reluctant to take it because, frankly, I'm an attorney. I understand that people who are accused of rape have a right to counsel. I choose not to represent people who are accused of rape. And the person who referred this to me said, you know, please don't make up your mind just based on this phone call. I'd like you to read the record. And I spent Labor Day weekend of 2016 going through this record, and by the time the weekend was over, my blood was boiling for the very reasons that Your Honor has mentioned. And, you know, I think in response to your question, you know, it's a difficult response for two reasons. You know, first and probably foremost, cases like this, in my view, don't belong at the university level. You've got a 19-20-year-old who's fighting, who in another context would be fighting for his life. You know, fortunately, the hearing committee at the university couldn't sentence him to prison, but they could pretty much ruin his life short of sentencing him to prison. That was basically the only thing they couldn't do, was send him to jail. And so, you know, what can the courts do in order to deal with this situation? It's a national problem. There are cases that are coming down left and right all over the country just over the last 5 years, and there are going to be more and more of them. And I think the only thing that the court is really in a position to do is obviously deal with the facts that are before it. And in this case, I think that what the court would need to do is point out the deficiencies with respect to what happened at the hearing, explain in detail what substantial evidence is, and how that standard is satisfied in a case such as this, where, for example, you have two independent eyewitnesses sitting 3 feet away. And the hearing committee doesn't make a finding or even an evaluation as to those witnesses' credibility. The hearing committee's finding was simply, well, you know, maybe the eyewitnesses didn't see it. Maybe they were wrong. Well, I think there has to be, you know, some guidance by the court that says, you know, if at the very least, if you've got something along the lines of eyewitness testimony, before you reject that testimony, you'd better at least make a finding and evaluation as to whether those witnesses are credible. And if they're not credible, that's fine. And I'm not here to talk about credibility, because I know that in this context, credibility is the third rail for me. If I stray into credibility, I'm done. But at the very least, I think the court needs to explain to universities that if you're going to reject something like eyewitness testimony, you had better first make an evaluation with respect to whether or not these people were, the witnesses were credible or not.
That's one of many things. I think we should probably, we're familiar with the facts.
I understand that.
I just have a couple of questions.
Sure.
And I don't know how Mr. Miller feels at this point. But anyway, well, we have a number of questions for him as well. We have some real questions about due process and so on. It seems to me that there are two elements of this case. One is the due process aspect. The other is the substantial evidence question.
Correct.
Which you can respond to that. I don't think we need to go over all of that now. Let's assume we agree with the first point. About a lack of due process. Taking into account this is not the same kind of due process you would have in a court hearing.
Sure.
We realize it's university setting. There's that Doe versus USC, whatever it is, and the
yes.
Gold-Kelly and Goldberg case. The
right.
U.S. Supreme Court, we're familiar with all of that. And all right. So if we just get to that point, what happens?
Well, if the court...
What do we do if we agree with you on the first issue?
If the court agrees that
there was a lack of due process.
There was a lack of due process and not a fair hearing.
Yeah.
I think the court, you know, orders the Superior Court to reverse its denial of our petition and to direct the university to vacate the findings that it reached.
And then what? What happens then?
Well, at that point...
Is there another hearing?
I think Judge Geck, or whoever the Superior Court judge would be who receives your order,
yeah,
would certainly have the option under okay. CCP 1094.5 to order a new hearing.
Okay, now let me get to the second issue.
Sure.
Let's assume, and we'll talk about that. You've sort of hit upon that in your response to Justice Perrin's question. Let's assume we decide there's a lack of substantial evidence. What happens then? What if we agree on both issues and we say there is no substantial evidence here? Do they get a second bite of the apple or what?
Frankly, if the court agrees that there's no substantial evidence, they shouldn't have a second bite of the apple. I think at that point, it begs the question, what would a second bite of the apple even achieve? And would it be a denial of due process to allow a second bite at the apple if there wasn't substantial evidence that was presented in the first place?
You don't get to keep going back to
exactly.
Make it right.
Go
ahead.
The whole concept of taking the second prong of the analysis being presented, in a criminal case, a court makes a finding, any court at any level, that there's a lack of substantial evidence, that's it, party over. But that's a double jeopardy constitutional issue in a criminal environment.
What about a civil case?
There may be some sort of, I don't know how the civil cases work on that. There may be something to that, I don't know. I guess my question was much of what Justice Gilbert just said. You've told us what order you would two orders that are alternative orders.
Sure.
Is there a limitation in your perception, and I asked Mr. Miller the same thing, in any order that we make that we would be the defining force? A, there's lack of substantial evidence, end of case. B, the case was fraught in the application of due process, go back and do it right, circumventing any orders of the trial court. They would just be a conduit back to the university. And the third alternative is, in reading the rules, the rules actually read beautifully. I have to be candid with you. They sound extremely fair at first reading, but they use a phrase like guilt or innocence. That's a curious word to use in a civil type proceeding or an administrative proceeding. More importantly, are we getting to there's a lack of due process as applied in this case?
That's my position. As I said at the outset, I don't take issue with
the rules.
With the rules on their face.
Yeah.
But as applied in this case, it was appalling.
Yeah. I think we've been over this ground. Yeah.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay, can we hear from Mr. I really want to hear from Mr. Miller. So
thank you.
We've really tipped our hand, haven't we, how we feel about this case. But I mean, there's a real, and you're the lawyer representing, you got a job to do. But I mean, with this panel, obviously, has serious, serious questions about due process here. And I'm talking about the due process in the context of a university hearing like this, and taking into account the Supreme Court case and the Doe case, Doe versus what is it? University of Regents of the University of California, and so on. So,
well, I see an uphill battle before me, but I'll start at the bottom of the hill and we'll work upward. Thanks very much, Justice Gilbert. May it please the court. Let me start with the concept of I don't think anyone disputes that there was proper notice of a hearing here. Clearly, the appellant had proper notice of a hearing. So, really, what I see the court zeroing in on in terms of the due process requirements articulated in Goss,
particularly in Gilbert. I was thinking of that, but let me interrupt you there. You're talking about notice, too. He comes to the hearing, and I think they say it'll be July 11th, whatever the date was. And he comes to the hearing, and he's got a witness which is the best friend of the victim, who's 3 feet away and says this didn't happen. And the university decides we're going to continue it. He comes to he's ready with his wit, but please don't continue it. She's going to be out of the country. She won't be able to testify. There's no advance notice, nothing. You show up with your lawyer, you've got your witness, you're all ready to go, and the universities talk about notice. Sorry, we're putting it off into August. Now, I understand she got to testify through Skype, but you know what? It's a lot different seeing somebody on a screen or on a, you know, it's like reception isn't always great, having a witness right there, and it's her best friend who says, if I thought anything like this happened, I'd be on her side. I'm on her side. So you consider that good notice?
Respectfully, let me address two issues. Let me address notice, but let me first take up the issue of testifying by Skype, because I think the court in the UCSD case clearly said that that was a permissible way to have witnesses testify and meets the constitutional due process.
So I
don't think that in and of itself.
Not in itself. It's just a question of continuing the hearing. When he's all down there, his whole life is at stake here. He comes in with his lawyer, no hearing today, and the person you brought who's ready to testify, too bad she's going to be out of town. I understand you can do Skype.
Okay. Let me start with the basic premise that he had 3 different notices of a hearing in the terms of what he was entitled to know when the hearing was coming and what he was entitled to review. I think that there's something very important that I need to clarify at the inception in terms of the administrative record, what he was entitled to know and what he was entitled to confront, because that seems to be an issue for this court. Let me start with the fact that on June 29, 2016, he was provided notice of that July 12th hearing. But more importantly, at AR 82, he was provided with an opportunity to review the hearing packet. I want to focus in on that for a moment. Because contained in that hearing packet at AR 9 was the 7-word portion of the SART report that talked about the bruising and lacerations. That's unredacted, and that
That
was unredacted, Justice Gilbert.
Here's what portion I have in the record. Everything's cut out of the thing.
If we look at AR, if we look at AR 09, it's not unredacted. It's an email from Detective Arviso, and that email was sent in October, and that was in the hearing packet that he had an opportunity to review, and that the university provided him an opportunity to review on June 29, 2016. Recall now that his hearing was not till August 16th of 2016.
Right.
John Doe contends to this court, the appellant, that he did not have an opportunity to review that SART report until the evening before his hearing. That's simply a false premise. There's a presumption of regularity in the university proceeding, and that presumption is that in that hearing packet, which is part of the administrative record, that that document existed at the time that the notice was provided to review the hearing packet back in June. He waited a month and a half. What's being missed here is that John Doe waited 1.5 months to go and review that packet until the eve of the hearing. It's not that the university didn't provide him ample opportunity. In fact, it provided him 3, and I'd like to articulate it because I think it's important. The first was the June 29, 2016 notice. In it, it explicitly said in the penultimate paragraph in that letter, you have an opportunity to come review the hearing packet. Please make an appointment with me to do so. Here's my email address. Here's my telephone number. That same notice was again provided on July 25th, 2016, in advance of the August 16th, 2016 hearing, and it was again provided on August 8th, 2016. So 3 notices of not only the hearing, but the opportunity to come and review the evidence. Why is that important? Because one of the things that the appellant contends is that his inability to review that 7-word statement from the SART report that was provided by the detective somehow prejudiced him. And of course, we know that in order for there to be a due process deprivation, he has to have been prejudiced. Had he gone and reviewed that packet a month and a half before the hearing, he certainly could have presented an expert to say whatever he thought was an alternative cause of those bruisings and lacerations. And to the extent that the appellant contends that expert testimony was not permitted, that's just flat false. He had an expert that testified at his hearing on whether he passed a polygraph test. That expert was freely permitted and considered by the hearing panel, I would add. So to the extent that the appellant wanted to have an expert on the issue of the SART exam and offer alternative causation or alternative theories, he certainly had a month and a half to do so on the undisputed record. You will not find anywhere in this record support for the assertion that the first time this appellant was entitled to review the SART information, the 7 words, was on the evening before the hearing. That was his own decision. All three times, that information was already contained in the report. Not only was the information contained, but the fact that it was provided by Detective Arvizo, who was going to be a testifying witness, was also known a month and a half before the hearing. Isolating the SART exam for one moment and turning to the Vibrant issue, because that seems to be another major source of contention in appellant's brief, that somehow on the night before the hearing he found out about the Vibrant for the first time. Let's talk about how the issue of Vibrant came to play in the administrative process. On August 8, 2016, it was Jane Rowe who for the first time provided two pages of the SART report exam that you're referring to. In the second page of that SART exam report was the indication that she was on Vibrant at the time of the incident, if you will. On August 8th, that same day, at AR 157, yet another notice via email went out to the appellant indicating, please come now and have another opportunity to review the hearing packet. Why was the third notice given? It wasn't because there was a further continuance of the hearing. The third notice was given because there was additional information provided by Jane Rowe that he fairly had an opportunity to review 8 days before the hearing. However, there simply is no prejudice on the Vibrant issue. The very simple fact is, on his witness list and evidence list that he provided on August 1st, he purported to want to provide warning labels on antidepressant medication that would show what the effects were under the guise of alcohol. For some inexplicable reason, certainly not by the university's doing, he simply failed to do that. In other words, at the time he got the hearing, and the hearing panel's report notes this, while John Doe had listed on his witness list these antidepressant labels and the warning labels and their effects, he simply chose at the time of hearing not to present that evidence. There's nothing in the record that says he tried and wasn't permitted. More importantly, if you look at the issue of Vibrant...
Some of that stuff's online, on the internet, and his mother was going to testify to that.
But even setting his mother aside, for example, for a moment, one of the things that John Doe literally put on his August 1st witness list, 16 days before the hearing, is I'm going to show documents, labels from antidepressant medication, and show what their side effects are. Fine. Nobody said that couldn't be on his witness list and his exhibit list. And as they got to the hearing, what the hearing panel noted is while it was on his, even though it was on his list, he just chose not to present it. At no point in the hearing did he ever say, and I want to present the labels. What he did present, though, is his own testimony about the fact that Jane Rowe was on Vibrid and that it would have affected her recollection of the events and that it could have caused hallucinations, irrespective of his mother's testimony. And that's in the record at 198. It's clear.
Okay, and so what is that?
And so the idea is he wasn't prejudiced from a disclosure of the Vibrid medication 8 days before the hearing. There's just no basis for that to be a due process deprivation. He knew about it at least 8 days before the hearing. In fact, arguably, he knew about it even 8 days before then when he put label information on his own exhibit list. So the idea is he knew 16 days before the hearing that he was going to present a theory based on the fact that she was undertaking some form of antidepressants that she might not have had a good recall and, in fact, was permitted to do so. I think the critical part is that that was addressed both in AR 202 and 203. The hearing panel concluded that they actually heard about his theory regarding Vibrant. He presented it. The mother's testimony was simply cumulative. I mean, the bottom line is the hearing panel had said, we heard your theory about Vibrant. We understand what your theory is. He then continued to try to proffer his mother as an expert on this issue and continue to have her testify. That was the only reason they didn't need to consider that. But that was not prejudicial. I mean, his theory was proffered. He had the right articulated in Goss. He had the right articulated in Goldberg to be heard, to present what he thought was the defining feature of why it was that he could not have committed this incident. But I take a step back. I heard from you, Justice Prent, and I respect your comment that the university, in some way, that the way that they pursued this policy and pursued this hearing somehow, took action that could greatly affect the appellant. However, I would highlight that the appellant's conduct, if true, and again, that's for the hearing panel to determine, took action that could have gravely affected Jane Rowe.
Let me interrupt you right there. That is a statement routinely made in every criminal case because there's always a victim. And if anybody thinks here that I am not deferential to understand and appreciate the trauma of sexual violence, they've heard me wrong. I truly do. But your argument assumes its conclusion, and the issue is the conclusion. Did it happen? and was the process that brought it forward one that was due? So I respectfully take exception to a comment that victims have rights too. That issue has long been accepted, respected, and enshrined in the law. I don't take any issue with it, and the allegations she makes are terrible. And the consequences to the minor, that's what I'd call them, I'm a juvenile court judge at one time, are also quite dramatic. My concern, as expressed to counsel at the beginning, is I've spent my life in the criminal law. I really have, over 50 years. And I've watched thousands of these cases and tried them. And the notion that a kid goes into a room with, on paper, what appears to be guarantees of due process somehow seems to me to miss the point. He's a kid accused of an incredibly serious crime where somebody is allegedly severely injured emotionally and sexually, and he's all of a sudden the roof falls in on him, and you're telling me, well, he had an opportunity, and that's exactly the point. The kid is a kid who doesn't have any representation, or he has somebody he can consult with. I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I see this kid sitting in front of adults accused of sexual violence crimes, and he's carrying the hod here to say, well, you know, I didn't do it, and here's why. Lawyer stands up and says, no, you sit down. You don't have a right to be here and participate, but you can advise your kind. I try and put myself in the kid's shoes. It's just amazing. I did that because I don't want any misunderstanding. The gravity of this for both the victim and the accused is enormous. I understand that.
All right. That was a statement from are you going to respond if you want? I have a question about the Vibrig.
I'd like to answer both. I'd like to respond briefly and answer your question, Justice Gilbert. I would say, Justice Perrin, I certainly didn't in any way or shape or form mean to infer what your comments were. I think it was made for another purpose, which was the fact that the requirements to hold student conduct proceedings, the requirements to go through this process, are mandated in part by Title IX, by the Department of Education. So I think what has to be appreciated by the court is that, for example, if the university doesn't take action under its policies to bring people who are accused of sexual assault to a hearing and have an opportunity to be heard, you know, they themselves can incur liability under Title IX theories for being deliberately indifferent,
for
example.
Of course, we're getting to broad philosophical, which I want to get back to the case. All right, Reporter's Transcript 22, what I see there, and you tell me if I'm wrong, John, it's true that he was aware she was taking an antidepressant prior to the hearing. He states that he didn't learn of the medication, of the Vibrid, until the night before the hearing of August 16th when he received the hearing packet. So you're saying he had all this advance notice. Am I reading this wrong, or what have I got wrong here?
That's the point of critical importance to clarify for this court. Yes, Justice Gilbert.
He didn't have this knowledge. He knew she was taking some kind of med, but he didn't know what it was until the night of the hearing.
No, I think what we have to clarify is that he had an opportunity to know what it was several days before the night of the hearing. In other words, the question is whether the university's process was unfair, not when he decided to review the information.
I see what you're saying. All right.
And what I'm trying to say, if I just may, is that the university, upon immediate receipt, on the same day it received this further information of Vibrant on August 8th, provided him another opportunity to review that information, so the process was not fair. The due process was not violated.
I got it. All right. Now, he asked her some questions about the side effects. And her answer was, it's my private medical information. I'm not going to tell you. And then that's when he talked about the hallucinations and all that kind of stuff, right? That's what happened at the hearing?
That's correct.
Yeah, then the mother attempted to testify. And what I found interesting here is when John wanted to ask his mother about the Vibrant and the effects, the chair stated he was advised by campus counsel not to accept it. Now, that struck me because he has counsel who can't ask any questions or do anything, and now campus counsel is there asking telling them what to ask and not ask. Is that appropriate? Yeah. Under the rules?
I think the first issue is it a due process deprivation? And I think the law is very clear that the right to counsel in a student administrative hearing is not a due process right. I understand that if you have a criminal background and that you have a criminal trial, that's an automatic right. You know, the right to counsel in a criminal proceeding. But I would say that in the Anderson case, for example, it's very clearly articulated that in these proceedings, there's not a full panoply of criminal due process.
Does that mean that the university, the counsel, can advise and object? I'm asking. I looked at these cases, the Doe case, and never seen anything like this where they're holding a hearing and all of a sudden the attorney for the university, oh, hey, don't answer that, don't do this, where his attorney doesn't, he can be there or she can be there, but they don't get to ask any questions or do much of anything.
I think number one, obviously, we know in this particular case the appellant did have experienced counsel with him at the time of the hearing.
And, yeah.
To advise him to make whatever record he wanted, you know, tell him to stand up and make an objection, do whatever he thought was appropriate to preserve his rights. He certainly had an advisor there who could have done that. And in fact, he did do that. He did object to the way certain evidence was treated. But I think more importantly, you have to look at that portion of the record in its whole context, which was at that time, John Doe had already testified about what his theory of hybrid was. In fact, the hearing officer, Miles Ashlock, had already acknowledged, Mr. Doe, we understand what your theory is. Your theory is that she took this medication and that it caused some hallucinogenic
effect. There was testimony that she was speaking in foreign languages and she was utterly confused. She didn't know where she was. Her best girlfriend said that.
Well, and her best girlfriend, if I may, in the Facebook messages, had already previously said in those messages right after the incident that she believed that perhaps maybe John Doe had engaged in this, but we should be forgiving of him because if he did it, he didn't mean to. And then only later, at the time of the hearing, did she change her testimony before the panel that, of course, he didn't engage in this at all. So, you know, you have a hearing panel who's hearing, on one hand, Facebook messages, multiple Facebook messages, which articulate that it's possible this happened, and then a change in story.
I want to get back to my original question. Is the chair or the chair of this committee allowed to have campus counsel advising what to do? Is that comport with the rules?
There's nothing in the rules that say that they can't, and more importantly, you know, the idea in a case where you've had somebody already present evidence, and now you have, in this case, John Doe continuing to try to present other means of the same evidence. It's becoming cumulative. We've all seen this, Your Honor, the same things being testified over and over. There's nothing that deprives due process where a campus counsel would say, in that instance, you know, we've heard the evidence or advised the hearing panel they've heard it. I mean, it's no different than counsel advising a Skelly hearing officer or some other instance. Certainly that doesn't deprive due process to have legal counsel in those settings.
I want to just jump in because you're educating me and I appreciate that. I will go back to something I asked before. Number one, and most important, looking at the facts, the gestalt of the record as it comes before us out of the administrative hearing, what role, if any, does this court play in assessing those facts? Is it substantial evidence? Do we take it like we find it, make all inferences in favor of the result, and just say, well, you know, we may think otherwise, but there's facts here that justify it, and end of case?
I think it's twofold. To the extent that the process and procedures truly weren't followed, obviously this court has a right to review those issues, just as the trial court did on a de novo basis. But to the extent that there's arguments about who should have been believed at the hearing, should it have been Jane Roe who was believed over John Doe? The factual component of it. I mean, certainly
it is de novo review.
Correct.
Of course.
Correct, Justice Gilbert. But what I would say on that is certainly there's a tremendous deference that's given under the substantial evidence standard that the hearing panel was in the best position to judge credibility in this case. I would certainly remind the panel that Jane Roe did testify at the hearing and talked about the significant emotional impact it caused on her, the fact that she dropped out of school, the fact that she had significant episodes following this incident. So they were in the best position, again, to weigh these different accounts. Eyewitness one, who changed some of what she said between the time of this incident and the time she testified, John Doe and Jane Roe. And all I would add in that component is that the substantial evidence test is met by the belief of the testimony of a single witness. That's axiomatic. It's well established. And in this case, the hearing panel was entirely justified to believe Jane Roe, given the different accounts in this instance, and rely on that to support it. And that's a tremendous amount of deference, even if the court thinks that the hearing panel should have decided otherwise, is extended in that regard and should be. I would like to just, if I may, just for one brief moment more, since the criminal context has come up, I really do think it's important to highlight some of the issues that were at play. For example, in the Ohio State case we cited, when they were analyzing the Gomes case, I mean, they were looking at whether, you know, sort of Brady-type issues applied, whether there should be some mandatory disclosure of all the kind of evidence that we're used to seeing related in a criminal proceeding. And they acknowledge that that's not a constitutional deprivation, that that's not what's required here. All that is required, and I return to the fundamental basis, is notice of hearing, of which we had three notices of hearing, and the opportunity to be heard and tell John Doe's side of the story. John Doe testified that he didn't commit this incident. John Doe testified that there were other justifications for why Jane Roe may have believed this happened, even if it didn't, including the vibrant. He testified to that. So the, quote, late disclosure, which really isn't true, didn't prejudice him. John Doe called other witnesses. There were no witnesses other than his mother who was simply providing cumulative testimony that were not permitted to testify. He called an expert witness that was permitted. He brought a mattress to the hearing. There was significant evidence presented by John Doe in this case. I think the trial court correctly analyzed that when you look at it in the total confines of due process, he had notice of a hearing. He did, in fact, have an opportunity to tell his story. I recognize that there could have been criminal proceedings pending. I recognize that, you know, certainly somebody could be instructed not to answer. But you do look at those competing interests, as we talked about just a moment ago, Justice Gilbert, against the requirements of the university to act. They do have policies for a reason. There are legal mandates on these universities to have policies, to follow their policies, and to bring sexual misconduct, if it's alleged, to hearing. And it was alleged here.
No question.
And so I think the question really is, was there truly a due process deprivation in this case? And if we look at every component of the law, there is nothing that appellant has clearly articulated that is a due process deprivation when you really get down to it. I mean, it really is looking at the Skype issue and saying, well, no, that's already been held not to be a constitutional deprivation.
Well,
it's those kind of issues. Any other questions, I'm happy to answer.
I want to know who wrote these rules. Where did your office write these rules? Do they come from some regent in Berkeley? I mean, where are we starting?
As much as I'd like to take credit for what Justice Brent said are well-drafted rules, I did not write them, Justice Egan. No. These are university rules that are both written at the local level for implementing rules as well as the region system-wide policies. And again, if you take a look at the Department of Education's requirements, you know, we're required to have processes that are what's before you. We're required to have and take action in cases where there's allegations of sexual assault. We have an obligation to protect our further campus community. All of these are important things that we have to do. It's not simple. I understand what we're bringing before you is not easy. These are challenging issues.
Well, what I really want to know is, did some person without a legal background write these rules?
I don't think that would be possible, Justice Egan, because they do provide for due process. In other words, they do provide for an opportunity to review information before a hearing. That's a simple right to a fair hearing. In this case, three opportunities were provided. If anything, when I continued to look at the reply brief articulating that somehow this was discovered on the evening before the hearing, I take some offense to that because the clear administrative record doesn't support that. That's just a false statement in the record. There were three opportunities to review that hearing packet. And how do we know it's in the hearing packet? Because it's in the administrative record. And again, I would go back to the California Youth Authority case and the presumption of correctness in the administrative proceeding. Not at any time was there ever an articulation here that what we claimed was in the hearing packet, the portions of the SART examination, the portions of the vibrant, was in fact not in the hearing packet. That's never been articulated. In fact, when he finally went to review the hearing packet, what do we know? He got to look at all that information. Had he just done it a month and a half sooner, maybe we wouldn't have these issues.
I want to know who these trained fact finders are. Are they lawyers?
In this case, they were not lawyers.
What is their background, training, and experience?
Well, I think the critical part is that Mr. Ashlock, for example, works in the Office of Judicial Affairs, so he has significant training on issues of adjudicating, pursuant to our university policies, these matters. I mean, in other words, you have a three-panel or a two-panel group of individuals that are looking at these issues on a daily basis. I mean, this is
his
job.
Does this person have some legal training, a law degree, a license to practice law?
You know, I know it's not before the court, Your Honor, but I would say that certainly these people are trained to do their job in the Office of Judicial Affairs. Yes, I mean, the university does not put people in a title of Office of Judicial Affairs without extensive training on what the policies are, how they are to be interpreted, how the hearings are to be conducted. I mean, Mr. Ashlock, I know, for example, has conducted numerous hearings on these issues. I mean,
shouldn't a fact finder be neutral? What you said, this person works for the university?
Correct. I mean, we are required to have, again, by the mandates of the Department of Education, otherwise, we are required to have administrative processes that investigate incidents of claimed sexual assault, that review and offer an opportunity for notice and to be heard. I mean, again, these are requirements in Goss versus Lopez. I mean, we are required to have a notice and an opportunity to be heard. So we are required to have departments that allow and afford these opportunities. The policies are drafted to have both an investigation and to have an adjudication. And the people that are doing the adjudication work in this capacity every day, just as people who, you know, work in our capacities every day. I mean, this is what they do. And so they are trained on the policies. They are trained on how to provide clearly three different letters providing notice to the individual, even when they got new evidence. I mean, that's good training, right? If you get new evidence presented by one party, good training suggests issue a letter to the other side and make sure that they know about it before the hearing. That happened here. These kind of things, were appropriate.
Well, and so if one of the goals of the law is a fairness and the appearance of fairness, and the hearing officer apparently works for the University of California. Why don't we have an independent hearing officer? Right? Someone from, you know, someone who's been a retired judge, I don't know. Someone other than an employee of the university.
I appreciate the suggestion. I guess what I would say is that we have innumerable instances in public entities where people who work for the entities are civil service commissioners. We have innumerable instances where people who work for the institutions are Skelly officers. You know, this is not unique to have people who are going to be adjudicating matters in a public institution that are also public employees. That happens with great frequency.
Security exchange officers, for example.
I'm just saying
stockbrokers who sit.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about. You get to arbitrate this in front of the stockbrokers.
Yeah.
Here's the fundamental fairness, though, if I might, because it's important in the broader issue, is that there's certainly a right to appeal, and that right was exercised in this case. If you don't agree with the hearing officer, you have the right institutionally to appeal first and all the way up to the level of the chancellor. And then from there, and that's what the procedures provide, by the way, that's further due process. And then, of course, you have the right to take the writ, and you have the right to have a judicial officer, with all the training you're suggesting, make sure that that administrative agency provided due process, make sure that that administrative agency exercised fundamental fairness in the hearing. All I would offer to this panel is to look carefully at each one of the assertions that are being made in this case.
We're going to look carefully. I might just about ruin your day here. Let's just assume you lose. Are you going forward again with this? Or should we allow you to go forward with this again?
That's my question.
I think that's a difficult, in all fairness, that's a difficult question for me to answer without consultation with my client. I'm sure you can appreciate that.
I want to ask you a question about who is your client? The university, the regents of the University of California.
That is my client.
Yeah.
And as well as the chancellor and as well as the vice chancellor who were also named in this action.
What, say that again?
As well as the chancellor of the university and the vice chancellor who were also named in this action.
You mean Mr. Yang?
Yes.
Yes. Very nice man. He's going to become personally involved in this?
Well, he's been named as a respondent in the action.
And he has some authority here on whether to go forward or not again?
It was reviewed in the first instance. In other words, the appeal was to his office in the first instance. So certainly he will have an opportunity to weigh in here.
Okay. Does he have counsel?
I am his counsel.
You are his lawyer.
That's
so you have some counsel. Ability to you have know? Some but you're going to counsel him on that.
I will counsel.
I have the legal question. I must tell you, you've done just a marvelous job. We're buffeting you with questions, and man, you're handling this with real class and expertise that is really quite impressive. I just have to say that.
Thank you very much. That's high praise.
I agree. I think Justice Perrin agrees.
I think you're doing it. I mean, because this is apparently sounds like a pretty hostile panel. You know, there'll be cases like this where we've, and the the result is not always what you expect. So I'm not saying that's going to happen, but we're kind of exercised about this case. But let me ask you this. The question I asked Mr. Wilner. In the event, we have two issues, as I see it, the due process issue and the substantial evidence issue. Without arguing the substantial, let's assume we feel that there is not substantial evidence. What legally is it appropriate for us to say you're out of the this? It's the game's over, or what are you? What are your thoughts about that?
You know,
a background. We've had civil cases before, when
sure.
on those, and they're rare. But when we've had civil cases where there has not been substantial evidence, we've said, and there's appellate cases that have said that's the end of the ballgame. You don't get to go back and keep, you know, trying it again. You had your shot, and that's it.
I think that there, in these type of cases, certainly a deference that's owed to the administrative agency, and so it's remanded appropriately for further consideration in light of the instruction. You know, to the extent that there was, I mean, again, it really is the agency's decision at the end of the day, in this case, the university, to decide how best to proceed in
no,
light of
its
policies.
No, but I'm saying if we decide. I don't care what the university thinks at this point. I'm talking about what we think and what our authority is. Do we have the authority to say there's a lack of substantial evidence, and therefore this case is over?
I don't think so. In my experience, Justice Gilbert, when there is an issue with how an administrative proceeding was conducted and the adjudicating authority, whether it be the Court of Appeals or the trial court, believes it's done improperly, the proper procedure to follow is to remand that with instructions on how that should be handled and reconsidered.
But let's just take a civil case. Forget about an administrative agency. A civil case where there's a lack of substantial evidence. Does a trial court? I suppose it depends on the circumstances, what evidence was admitted and not admitted. But does the Court of Appeal have authority to say, hey, it's over?
I respectfully don't believe so. In other words, in my experience handling many, many writs over the years, you know, my experience has been that it's procedurally appropriate if the trial court disagrees that there was either due process or that there was substantial evidence, that the appropriate recourse is to remand with instructions and to be reconsidered.
Yes, but one of our instructions
could be
dismiss this case, dismissed. Order the university to purge its records, and this never happened. And so now this young man can go to med school.
I would ask the court, certainly the court's entitled to remand with whatever instructions it deems appropriate. I would just simply offer to you, as the court attempts to do so and look through this, to again measure each of the issues involving claim due process and decide against the law that's out there and of which there is ample authority that we've cited both in our briefs and today here for the court, that in looking at those issues, truly, the due process, at least the procedure that was applied, really was proper under the Constitution in terms of what's articulated in a student process, which is materially different from what's articulated in a criminal process. And if we find that there's not a quote-unquote due process violation, then truly this court should not reweigh what the hearing panel had a right to hear and evaluate in terms of actually looking at the witnesses. When I believe perhaps it was you, Justice Gilbert, who said, you know, what good is looking at a Skype screen and deciding credibility? Well, I think it's even harder to not have sat in front of these individuals and heard their testimony directly to decide whether or not they should be
preaching to the choir. We know those rules.
And I just think in this case, the hearing panel had that opportunity. They really did have a chance to weigh it on both sides, and they had a chance to look these people in the eye, and John Doe had a chance to be heard and decide whether or not this was true or not.
What? Who are the people? Who are there? There's two hearing officers now.
Correct. Typically, a panel of two or three.
Who are they?
It varies. In other words, it could be any member
here,
of the office
in
of
this
judicial
case,
affairs.
Who are the people
we,
in this
we,
case?
We had Mr. Ashlock, I believe, as one of the hearing officers.
Coach? Is he a coach?
I'm sorry.
Wasn't he a coach or was one of them a?
No, not Mr. Ashlock. Mr. Ashlock worked. He was a chairperson for the hearing panel.
One
and
of
he
the
worked,
other.
He worked in the office of judicial affairs. If you may, Your Honor, I can check here.
Well,
I have it right here, Your Honor.
I
Well, I guess the follow-up question is, you say these are trained hearing officers, but I want to know what their real job is. I mean, if the guy's the chairman of the engineering department, I'm not sure he should be sitting on the panel.
I have it right here, Your Honor. Thank you for your patience. It's Well, as I articulated with respect to the chairperson, Mr. Ashlock, if I may start there, that this is his job to be in the Office of Judicial Affairs and adjudicate over student conduct proceedings, and I want to be correct because I know that there are different.
You're saying he's in the office. Justice Yeager is just asking, what does he do at the unit? Does he teach a class and something, or is he
no? His full-time job is to work in the Office of Judicial Affairs.
He's one of the hearing officers.
And he was the chairperson of the board in this case.
And there's two, right? So I thought one was a PE coach. I don't know. But I may be wrong. I don't know. Well, why don't we hear that? I don't expect you to come up.
I just want one clarification, if I may, please. The words de novo review came up versus substantial evidence, which are two very different concepts, as I understand it. Are we, as a panel, allowed to retry the case on the paper?
No, I think that's what I'm saying in terms of the case. That's where I argue that the deference has to be given back to the hearing panel. I mean, that's really it's an extreme circumstance that their discretion and the way they reviewed the matter should be disturbed. And I just don't believe that this rises to that. I mean, we certainly had it would be different if this particular individual had to go to a student conduct proceeding and Jane Roe never testified. That Jane Roe never made a report in this case that needed to be investigated, that Jane Roe didn't provide testimony that these incidents actually did in fact happen to her, that Jane Roe didn't wake up with her pants off, which was undisputed, truly undisputed in this case by anyone. You know,
there was also evidence that she sometimes sleeps that way from her friend.
Of course.
So, you know.
And these are the difficult decisions that need to be made in every case where you're weighing credibility. But again, the substantial evidence standard and the deference that's provided is to defer back to the hearing panel to reach that conclusion.
You know, we're not our concerns here is not that it didn't happen or it did happen. Our concerns are the manner in which the hearing was conducted. So that's what this is all about. We don't know factually. I mean, we've heard evidence, and we're just saying, under these circumstances, we have real concerns about the due process, the kind of due process that's to be accorded a student hearing in this context, looking at the case law that we've seen. That's what our concerns are.
And I recognize those concerns.
You don't have to find this. This is going to.
It's going to bother me, Your Honor. I'll be waking up in the middle of the night tonight reminding.
You know what? I'll let you tell us. Well, we're hearing from this.
Thank you very much.
We'll have some responses.
Thank you. There are just a few points that I want to respond to. One relates to the vibrant issue. Counsel indicated that both in his briefing and here before the court that my client, had the opportunity to present his theory to the hearing committee. The antidepressant made a difference in her recollection and all of that. I think the fundamental point from my standpoint here is that there's a difference between having the opportunity to present a theory, which, admittedly, if you look at my client's questions, the committee would have realized, okay, this is what the theory is. There's a difference between having the opportunity to present your theory and having the opportunity to present your evidence. And what was denied my client was the opportunity to present his evidence.
Counsel says, wait a second. He knew about this a week or so ahead of time. He could have done all this kind of work ahead of time.
Well, frankly, Your Honor, that's not my recollection of the record, and I'm not going to fumble through the books to find it. However, assuming for the sake of argument that counsel is correct, that he had a week, if he had done his due diligence, he would have stumbled upon the name Vibrid, and there you go. The fact is, he came to the hearing with his mother, who is a professional engineer, who took the time on the very morning of the hearing to contact the manufacturer of Vibrid and find out from the people in their research department, you know, what are the potential side effects of combining Vibrid with alcohol? And she was told, you know, here are the list of possibilities. And it went, when he tried to present that evidence at the hearing, and let's keep in mind that under the university rules, we're not wedded to the formal rules of evidence. Bring it on. When he came to the hearing with his mother, who had done the research and had spoken to the manufacturer, and asked what I think were really, you know, intelligent questions, trying to elicit that testimony from his mom, the committee, you know, basically froze up and said, we've been advised not to hear this, and so we're not going to hear it. You know, we know what your theory is, but we're not going to, we know what your theory is, but we're not going to hear that your evidence in support of that theory. My client, and, you know, maybe his attorney whispered in his ear, I wasn't his attorney there, I don't know. But at that point, my client, you know, started asking some additional questions to get to the same endpoint, so that he could get that testimony from his mother, what she learned from the manufacturer. And it was at that point that the attorney from the university's general counsel's office, Ms. Hamill, probably realizing, he might actually be able to get an answer here, you know, stood up, actively said, hey, we're not going to let you ask that question. Why? Because you don't have the qualifications to lay the foundation for this kind of expert testimony. And so on the one hand, you've got the rules that say, oh, we're not wedded to the formal rules of evidence, but then, you know, in the breach, when it looks like evidence is going to come out that may support the defense and not support the complaining witness, the in-house counsel for the university basically grabbed the microphone and said, no.
Now who is this person? It's not this lawyer right here.
No, it's an in-house attorney named Nancy Hamill for...
And she works at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Correct, in the general counsel's office.
General counsel's office.
And she shut down the questioning by relying on one of the more technical objections that, you know, we all hear at a trial. And so that ended it right then and there.
So you say that is unfair and a violation of due process.
Well, it is. It's
okay.
Yes.
I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just saying, is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
And that, you know what I note is that the SART report gets in, so to speak, with a person saying, I don't have the expertise, but I know all about SART reports, and we only do them in rape cases and so on. And we, as a panel, have it in front of us with everything deleted.
Right. Exactly.
That's the irony of this thing.
Right. So that's one point that I wanted to raise. With respect to, and I don't recall which of you on has raised it, the role of my client's attorney at the hearing versus the role of Ms. Hamill, the university's attorney from the general counsel's office, it's clear in the rules that the student's attorney can be there to advise the student, but cannot actively participate in the hearing.
Right.
You sit there, a potted plant, you can whisper in the ear, but otherwise you can't do anything else.
So what you're saying is it's an unlevel playing field.
It's a very unlevel.
Okay, we got that.
When you've got an in-house counsel who can jump up, take the microphone and say, okay, you're out of order, we're not going to hear this, and my client's attorney is sitting there basically, you know, like Bobby Seale 45 years ago at his trial in Chicago, you know, with his bound and gagged, it's fundamentally unfair. I guess the last point I want to make, and it's something that Mr. Miller raised, and he's absolutely right. There's language in the Doe UCSD case that says, you know, the testimony of a single witness single witness can constitute substantial evidence.
We have that in civil and criminal cases.
Well, of course.
So we say that that happens all the time.
It happens all the time. And in that particular case, there was no other evidence. I mean, if you've read that case, it's a bizarre situation because the accused presented no evidence. So yes, the testimony of a single witness in that case won the day because there was no other evidence. But if we're going to take the position that, well, as long as there's a testimony of a single complaining witness and that's going to carry the day, then what's the point of the language in the statute, in 1094.5C, I think, that says the definition of substantial evidence has to be taken in the context of the entire record. And so, you know, where you have a situation, you know, such as here, where you've got, you know, the single witness offering her testimony, but then you look at an entire record, the eyewitness testimony, I don't want to use the word bizarre, but the claim that, you know, I as the complaining witness was raped anally, vaginally, disrobed, my breasts were grabbed, my nipples were bitten and harmed. The person who did this to me was also taking photos of me while I'm doing this, despite the fact that we have a thick quilt physically in between us, and two neutral people are seated 3 feet away and say, this never happened. Well, that's the part of the entire record. And it doesn't put this court in a position of having to judge credibility to look at the record, the entire record, and say, this just doesn't make sense. And we're not going to say we're straying into areas of credibility by saying it simply doesn't add up. It doesn't add up to substantial evidence.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And you found it.
Yeah. In AR-177, it articulates the people who were present at the hearing, including, as I mentioned, Mr. Ashlock, the IVCC chair, Carrie Tran, who was also on the IVCC, which is the committee who hears these matters. Again, these are trained people who do this job every day. These are not people teaching other classes. These are people who work in the office. You note that Sandra Vasquez was there as the conduct officer for the Office of Judicial Affairs. You would also note that Robin Brown, who also works in the Office of Judicial Affairs, was present and part of the process. So the individuals who were part of the process, just to be included.
They're all employees of the University of California.
They are employees to do this job. In other words, this is the job.
There is an irony here for just a moment. You're looking at three employees of the state of California who were arguing the case before, and all of us are graduates of the University of California. So where do we go from that?
Oh, we have to recuse ourselves. Uh-oh. Okay, thank you. The matter is under submission.